Radio for Catholic and other Christians. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
Hudson, welcome to Church and Culture. This show is devoted to exploring the interaction between our faith and our culture. Each week, I will talk with expert guests on topics ranging from literature, art, and music to politics, liturgy, spirituality, and education. Thank you for joining us. Guest today is Lisa Bourne. Lisa's been a friend for a number of years. She and her family hail from Des Moines, Iowa. She describes herself as a Catholic wife, mother, and journalist with LifeSite News. But she does many things for the church. She has been in communications work and journalism both inside the church and as a Catholic journalist outside. She's worked vigorously in the pro-life community and is very active at the parish level as well as the diocesan level. And she's an excellent writer, speaker, and photographer, as I found out myself when I met her for the first time in Des Moines. Lisa Bourne, welcome to Church and Culture.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I asked you to come on because I wanted to get some help in understanding the controversies surrounding Cardinal Robert Sarah, who is the prefect for the Congregation for Divine Worship and the Discipline of the Sacraments. And you have been covering this, as well as a lot of other things, with LifeSite News. You know, my opening question is this. From a distance, it appears to me that Cardinal Sarah has become sort of taken the place of Cardinal Burke in the Vatican. You think that's a fair observation?
I think that's a fair observation, Deal. It looks as if by him doing what he did in asking for consideration for the return to the Ad Orientem liturgy, that's now put him in a bit of a white-hot spotlight.
Well, wasn't it something of a surprise in the first place when Pope Francis appointed him? Because in my reading, I do in fact prepare for these interviews, Lisa. In my reading, I came across an article that said that it was a big surprise to sort of the Pope Francis crowd because they thought that another cardinal, I'm not going to name him, who was more progressive, was a shoe-in for that particular job. And
yeah, I think it was
a surprise.
I think that's kind of, that would require probably seeing into the mind of the Holy Father, which if we had that ability, there'd be a lot more questions answered at this point.
Right. We wouldn't worry about him getting on airplanes anymore.
That's true. he's good at something probably none better than throwing his curveballs, I will say.
Listen, I kind of love the quirkiness and the surprises. You know, frankly, covering the church can get pretty boring at times. Everything is so scripted. But, of course, when you get off script, like even with a politician, you risk being misunderstood or you miss misspeaking, and you just have to sort of sort it out afterward.
Well, and there has been such a focus in the past on having such guarded speech, I think, coming out of Rome, and that's another thing that makes this pontificate so very different. Is, you know, clearly that appears to be out the window. So,
literally at 30,000 feet.
Yes. Yes. So I think that whether it's in appointing folks or off the cuff interviews, or responses to some things that folks have said that have been appointed. We never quite know from one day to the next what we're going to get. So that it's certainly keeping things interesting.
Well, what makes Cardinal Seurat a bit bulletproof is that he was born and raised in a one-room shack in Africa. And so no one can say of him that he doesn't care for the poor. He was a poor.
Mm-hmm.
And he became a priest and then a bishop at age 37 among the poor of Africa, and specifically of Guinea. And so he is not someone who is vulnerable to being attacked, say, the way Burke was, or even Cardinal Pell, for coming from Western first world countries. I think that's right.
Absolutely not. He's not in an ivory tower in any sense of the word, coming from that perspective. So that you make a really good point.
He is though 71, and he looks 55, if I might. Do you think that's true? I mean, he's got beautiful head of hair, and he just looks like he's vigorous and young and ready to keep going.
Well, and the African cardinals and bishops, I think in general, just from the broad perspective, where they're coming from, they really have to put their money where their mouth is and saying that they're going to serve the Lord. It's not the same thing over there as it is over here. So, if you will, a lot more street cred in putting their life on the line to serve.
But you can die over there for being Catholic.
Thank you. Yeah. You said it perfectly there. So that's not to make a blanket statement that, you know, they're all this and we're all that or what have you. But, I just want to underscore your point that he's not coming from a perspective of not knowing the people at all.
He has spent enough time in the Vatican among the Curia to know the ropes. I mean, he served for 9 years as secretary of the Congregation for the Evangelization of Peoples. And he's described as sort of a Ratzinger man, which, do you think that's fair to say?
I would, if we're having to put people in camps, then sure.
But he's a Ratzinger man, as we've already described, who does not come from the West and does not come from a background that would make him liable to criticism for disrespecting multiculturalism or not caring about the poor and so forth. And it is interesting that he moved from evangelization, which is a very outward-reaching and requires creativity and is very much part of the evangelization project announced in November of 1987 by Pope Paul II, now Saint Pope John Paul II. But liturgy is another animal, and I've been in the Vatican enough to know that the most, left-wing and non-traditional Catholics reside in the offices of liturgical matters.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder how he is going to survive, especially given his last pronouncement. Would you, Lisa Bourne, would you remind our listeners what it is that stirred the pot so much that Cardinal Seurat said about a month ago?
Well, it was July 4th, and it was at a sacred liturgy conference in the UK, and he asked very respectfully, if you go look it up, he actually made an appeal to his brother bishops to consider restoring worship to Ad Orientem, where you're facing the tabernacle. And there's a lot of misconception with this. I'm certainly not going to pretend to be a liturgist or a theologian. I'm a cradle Catholic who comes from a very blue-collar background, who is thirsty for knowledge in the general sense, but also as I've gotten older and deepened my faith, and you know, my eyes have been opened to what's gone on in, you know, during my lifetime, because a lot of it has happened during my lifetime, it's made me even more hungry to know these things. So I've come from the standpoint of having my upbringing in catechesis in the aftermath of all of these liturgical changes and having it presented to me as if this is normal. But I also remember, if nothing else, people talking about the communion rails being taken out and such. So, you know, I kind of feel like I've got a foot back there, at least having heard about it in anecdotes and such. So it's made me very, very hungry, but I've also been in the pews not having a clue what's being done in front of me and why it's being done. So I you know, I'm speaking from that perspective. I didn't know about what that even meant at Orientum, you know, why we're facing this, anybody's facing anything. So I feel like I've got the perspective of a lot of people of waking up throughout all of this. So he very respectfully asked for the bishops at their discretion, I believe. That would have been...
No, this was not an order coming on high.
No. And he also requested that they consider going back to kneeling for communion and even more use of Gregorian chant. These are all things that were integral prior to the changes that happened after the Second Vatican Council. And my understanding is that there's also misperceptions about what that council even directed in terms of liturgy. And I want
Well, if you recall, that council directed the continuous use of Latin.
Right.
Which has not happened.
Something came to my mind earlier when you were speaking about the cardinal from his move from evangelization to liturgy. Those two are intertwined. One of my favorite sayings, and I'm not sure if it's who it actually should be coined to, but save the liturgy, save the world. That I think that there's a reason that there's a pushback. There's probably more than one reason that there's a pushback toward this, but it is integral to reaching people. Evangelization isn't just preaching and teaching the doctrine. Those are obviously crucial aspects, but the way we worship is just as important and critical in our salvation.
Ad Orientum, facing the East or facing the people. Lisa Bourne, can you summarize the arguments on both sides of that?
Well, as I understand the argument for versus populum, and I'm probably butchering the Latin there, facing the people.
No, you got it. You got it.
I can sing it better than I can say it. And I can sing it better than I can understand.
Do you sing, too, in addition to all the other things you do?
I do. I canter for the basilica.
Okay.
We'll leave that there, but and that's another thing that I just, again, I'm a total down-to-earth blue-collar person. I love the Latin, whether or not I have a full understanding of every last word of it. And one of my assignments years ago, I had to follow a seminarian around and do a little profile, and one of those bits of the day included his Latin class. So I sat through a seminarian's Latin class with him, and it was just fascinating to me, and I love Latin. I just that's on my many, many long list of things that I'd love to get to someday to have a better grasp of it. But as I understand, facing the people, the argument for that is to engage them. I think it's a misunderstanding, but maybe a better way of putting it, I don't know. But the priest has his back to the people when it's ad orientem. That's not the case at all. He's leading them to Christ. And the focus is not on him, it is on Christ. So I want to say that people have a misunderstanding of what it means to be engaged in Mass if they think that the priest leading them to Christ is him having his back turned to them. So that those are the two basic arguments as I understand them.
I'd like to throw this in here. Some years ago I had a discussion with Cardinal George on this issue. And he reminded me of something that I once knew, but I had forgotten, and that is that the Church believes that there are four versions of real presence. One is the Eucharist, of course, but the other three are the Word being preached, the priest himself in his priesthood, and the people of God. So But, however, within that foursome, the Eucharist has a primary role, that the other instances of real presence, as they were, are derived from the Eucharist. So one argument that could be made on behalf of the versus populum is that the priest is facing the real presence, is, you know, the people of God representing that. And personally, the only time I've ever been in a liturgy which the priests were facing away were in Moscow at St. Basil's at a Russian Orthodox. And on my journey into the Catholic Church, I gave Greek Orthodox a try,
mm-hmm.
and went through a two-hour liturgy, which pretty much did me in. But the priests were not only facing away, they were behind little lattices where you could hardly see them at all. And I'm a convert at age 34, and I, so like you, even though you're not a convert, but you're of the generation that did not experience what has been described as the great power and symbolic significance of liturgy done facing the east, and the rising of the sun, the rising of Christ, and there's so much great poetry, of course, that comes to mind, George Herbert and John Donne and others. But as you've underscored, the controversy surrounding this seemed to imply that Cardinal Seurat was making this some sort of requirement, and that's simply not the case, is it?
Not at all. He like I said, he very respectfully asked that the bishops consider it, and you know, some of the things you were saying, where possible, with prudence, with the necessary catechesis, and also with all the pastors understanding that this is something good for the church, something good for our people, he very much qualified it as a request that was a good thing and the best for the people. So this was not an edict at all, and I think that a lot of people felt the need to jump on it as if it were, because felt threatened by it.
Why do you say that? I mean, I noticed that the reaction was mixed, but mostly in the direction of the negative reaction. Why is that the case? Is this symbolic of another range of conflict within the church?
I think it is. And again, this is my, I'm just going to say it, semi-educated opinion, but in my time covering the church, I've had to do a lot of waking up, as I alluded to earlier, but I encountered in a journalistic roundtable just over email back when Summorum Pontificum was released, that there was palpable hostility. People were just saying, I was shocked that people were saying some of the things that they were, and it was, I don't know, it's been years, and it still shocks me that was the response, but I've seen that here and there throughout, so I think that people are threatened to some degree, and I am still trying to understand why there is such a negative reaction on the part of some to the old rite.
But I think you know, and you're not. I think you, Lisa,
partake of it themselves.
I think you know, but you're not saying. I think you know, but you're not saying.
Well, I don't want to presume to know anyone else's parts.
But okay, so let me start the ball rolling. You know that I've been around, and I've been to Vatican many times and rubbed shoulders with quite a few people. This was mostly during the pontificate of St. John Paul II.
Mm-hmm.
And I was privy to instances where very high-ranking clerics talked openly about their wish that John Paul II would die as soon as possible.
My.
Okay. And they wanted him to die as soon as possible so that his influence could be countermanded. They could be turned back toward what they considered to be the true spirit of Aggiornamento in Vatican II. Now, when Pope Benedict was elected, it was completely devastating to the same group of people. And so you had folks like John Allen quickly rewriting his book on Cardinal Ratzinger, which was, you know, a thorough critique of Ratzinger from the left. He had to rewrite it to make it positive so that he wouldn't lose his access to the Vatican. And he was successful in doing that. And so then you had the same people, you know, holding their breath for the end of Benedict's papacy, which he came earlier than many people thought because he retired. He stepped aside. And with the with the election of Pope Francis, these people have been put into power. These people that have been waiting in the wings since the late 1970s are now in charge, and the last thing they want is a Pope Francis appointed prefect making noises that sound like the program of St. John Paul II or Benedict XIV. And it just, and frankly, it drives them into a fury because it's symbolic of everything else that they don't want the church to be. Everything else is contained. In fact, in some ways, I would venture, Lisa, that the liturgical practice of facing toward the east is perhaps the most powerful symbol that can be put in their faces because it represents the pre-Vatican II liturgical practice.
I think you've hit the nail on the head right there that it as far as what it represents. And going back to the Cardinal's own references when he was asking for it, let us again turn toward the Lord. Interestingly, some of the pushback has included some sort of inference that the request that the cardinal made was somehow drawing attention to away from the Lord, when that's in fact the opposite. It's interesting that we've gotten to a point, I think, in society and journalism and however you want to say it, media, just public discourse, where people can actually say the opposite of what something is and have it apparently be a passed off as reality in some people's minds. So you've hit it on the head. I think that not only does it represent what the liturgical practice was before, but it also represents having our focus where it should be on the Lord who is coming. So I would have to say if there's folks with a problem with that, then there's some other questions that are being asked there, or presented there. Why is there a problem with us focusing on the Lord? Because that's where we should be focused, and that's our goal. Our end goal is to be with Him in our salvation.
Lisa, it's like the abortion issue. The abortion issue, if you stand before this crowd, let's call them progressive Catholics, and I'm just going to generalize, they're not all like this, but we're talking about the crowd who felt stung by Cardinal Seurat's, you know, suggestion, and you raise the issue of abortion, you are immediately categorized as a ultra-right-wing Catholic, ultra-conservative. They always use the word ultra for some reason. I don't know why. Extreme isn't enough. Far-right, you know, it's ultra seems to be the worst thing you can be called in the Catholic Church. And so just as the abortion issue collects all the anger and discontent from the left, the facing of the priest toward the east, ad orientem, garners the same hostility and the same outburst. And it's like code. You know, you only have to say abortion and all everything else is filled in about who you are. You know, everything about you is immediately assumed. A, you never watch French movies, right? You only sit around and hate people who are, you know, pro-choice. That's all you do is you make up voodoo dolls and stick pins in them or something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And ad orientem, same thing. You're immediately put in a certain slot. Now, you're covering this from the journalistic angle for LifeSite News. And, of course, LifeSite News, I'll go on the record, just does such a great job. And when your name, your byline started popping up there, I was so pleased because when I met you some years ago in Des Moines, I thought, wow, this is a woman whose talent needs to be used, outside the parish and outside the locality of Des Moines. And it is being, and I'm very, very glad to see that you write beautifully and you report very fairly. You'll never be hired by NBC or CBS or ABC, especially CNN. And and you really do write well, which is unusual for journalists these days. Where do you think this is going to go? How is this going to play out? And first, in the near future.
Well, you're asking me, I guess, on some level to predict the future, but
I want you to speculate.
I think we need to be prepared for a potential second shoe to drop with the Cardinal. He had said that the Holy Father had asked him to continue the work of Pope Benedict in restoring liturgy. And these are my words, I'm paraphrasing. So restoring the liturgy to, or at least getting, you know, things back in the right direction from a reverence standpoint. So, but that appears to have been discounted to some degree by the very press office that serves the Holy Father. So we keep getting mixed signals that way, too. And it's interesting, in general, the prevailing humor is that the church moves so slowly and this, that, and the other. But there have been a few times in this pontificate when things happen quickly, with the case of Kim Davis and now in the case with the ad orientem worship, things happen very, very quickly. But you have to really read between the lines and see what's being said and who's saying them. There's people are very, very crafty these days as far as trying to communicate something, and they may or may not be directly quoting someone. So you really have to parse through. But I do, unfortunately, think we could be prudent in expecting another shoe to drop, and I don't know if that means that he'll be moved to a different post, as we saw with Cardinal Burke, but it's difficult to imagine there won't be some sort of action taken that way, simply because there was such a reaction, like we've been talking about, to this. So look for the Cardinal, see if he's going to speak anymore in the coming days, or if his assignment gets changed. That I think that's not out of the question, but again, we'll just have to wait and see.
I'm talking with Lisa Byrne, who is a journalist with LifeSite News, among many things. We'll be back with Lisa right after this short message.
Light of the East, weekends on Ave Maria Radio.
I'm Father Thomas Loya. This week on Ave Maria, teenagers hold a special place in salvation history and in the history of the Church. In ministering to teens, the Eastern Catholic Churches do best through their own liturgical and ascetical traditions.
Saturday evenings at 8:30 and Sunday mornings at 9 on 990 WDEO, Ave Maria Radio. Food for the Journey, Sister Ann Shields, on a recent self-discovery of how anyone can subtly help those seeking help from the Church.
One of the things I've found out in this era of the new evangelization is how many people are coming into our parishes during Mass, and they're curious, but they don't know what to do. And I've just been realizing that if I pray and say, Lord, lead me to the person who most needs you, it's as though God is preparing the way, and we have a place where we need to take some initiative. So I want to say to all our listeners, pray when you go to church. Don't just go to your comfortable place and sit down. Pray when you go in. Lord, if you need me, I am available to you. Show me who you want me to talk to. And if there is, God will have somebody come up to you, or you'll look at somebody's face and just say, I ought to go over and introduce myself. You know, we can do that. It's not that hard. I've gone over to people and just said, hello, my name is, and I haven't seen you before. Inevitably, no, I've never been here before, and this is what's going on in my life, and can you get me help?
Sister Ann Shields gives you food for the journey, weekday mornings at 6:45 and again at 10 a.m. on 990 Ave Maria Radio.
I am back with Lisa Bourne. Lisa is a journalist with LifeSite News. She's from Des Moines. She's a mom, a wife, a photographer, speaker, writer, very talented, has served at all levels in Catholic Church community. And we've been talking about the controversy surrounding Cardinal Robert Sarah, not Sarah, by the way, of Guinea, who is become the, I think, more or less leading spokesman among the Curia for the legacy of St. John Paul II and Benedict XIV. And just before break, Lisa, you thought that another shoe may drop and that we may see Cardinal Sarah moved because of his suggestion to Catholic pastors around the world that they don't have to face the people during the celebration of the liturgy, and particularly of the Eucharist. And that caused such a stir that he may be moved. Now, he's only been there, what, 2 years? Isn't that right?
I think so, since 2014.
Wouldn't it be very embarrassing, and wouldn't it be a complete, I mean, wouldn't it just be a complete news-type scandal if he were to be moved so quickly after being appointed?
Potentially so, but I think, as we alluded to earlier in our discussion, there's a little bit of an all-bets-are-off element anymore with media coverage and the Vatican. So I just don't think it's an impossibility, and it would depend on where he was moved to, because obviously there was a lot of speculation when Cardinal Burke got moved. Is this a punishment, or is this actually going to make him potentially more powerful? That sort of thing. So there's things you could read into just about anything. So it would depend. It would take some creativity in where he was moved to avoid some sort of PR debacle. But I think anything is possible.
Well, yeah, I think it's very significant that it was recently announced that Greg Burke would become the official Vatican spokesman. I would say that's of a piece with the surprise that Cardinal Sarah was appointed prefect of the Congregation for Divine Worship, because I know Greg Burke from many years ago when he was with ABC, and he was their correspondent in Rome, and everyone knows he's very traditional Catholic, conservative. He's not arch about it, certainly not ultra about it. He's been on Fox over the years a great deal, been on Raymond Arroyo's show a great deal. So it's, and I was completely surprised because I knew that that appointment was going through the process and was being considered, but the fact that it actually happened was kind of a surprise to me. What about you?
Well, you and I chatted a little bit about it, and you know, I had said that I don't know him, and obviously you do, but it was surprising on a lot of levels because there's not a lot of Americans in such prominent positions as well, so that was significant. But I was surprised as well, just hearing about it and from what you had said about him, for the very same reasons, that the way things appeared to be heading, he doesn't seem like he would be cut from the mold of a lot of the appointments that have been made during the pontificate. So it'll be interesting to see. I don't know if this is just another classic curveball or if there's other reasons. Again, if we could see into the Holy Father's mind, we'd have a lot of questions answered. So it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out.
In terms of the reaction in localities around the U.S. to Cardinal Seurat's suggestion, what has the coverage been like around in sort of from diocese to diocese?
I haven't seen a lot of coverage diocese-wise. I've been following folks that are liturgical in their focus, so they're happy to see it. They were happy to see the suggestion on the part of the cardinal, and others said that the excitement on the part of those was jumping the gun, I guess, because they thought that they kind of expected the other shoe to be dropping. So I think that people selectively will hear what they want to hear in a lot of cases and ignore what they want to ignore. Summorum Pontificum got ignored largely. If people weren't reacting hostily toward it, then it was largely ignored. So I think that it's probably going to pass under the bridge for a lot of folks. It's going to depend on whether or not you've got a bishop that is open to the idea and whether or not there's people in the diocese that are going to ask for this to be implemented. So that, I think that's going to drive it.
Now, when you moved from... because you were working in communications with the Diocese of Des Moines.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had what I would call an inside job. When you moved to LifeSite News, you were then thrown into the journalistic seat outside. How hard was it for you to make that transition?
Well, the transition was not immediate. There was a couple of year period in there, but it wasn't that hard at all, other than just kind of shifting gears in terms of how you approach people. By and large, the audience that I would have had working for a diocese and the subjects that I would have been approaching were all within a little bit more closed circle. I don't like to use the word closed, but, you know, a specific audience, a specific demographic within a diocesan church frame, whereas, you know, we are not representative of this church. We are not within the church with LifeSite, although we do, most of LifeSite's employees are Catholic. It very much has a Catholic ethos, and we report heavily on the church. So we just have the freedom of not having to operate within the institutional church. So it was just a matter of shifting gears because our audience is much bigger and broader in terms of the demographic, and also our subject matter would broaden as well. But I would just say the one served the other, actually. It was a matter of taking what I had experienced and gained and learned and being able to apply it now to a broader venue.
But isn't it the role of the outside game, the journalists outside the church, to be honest critics of the church?
I think it is, absolutely.
And did you have any trouble with that?
Oh, absolutely. There's lots of folks, and this is just not unique to us, but there have been a lot of concerning things during this pontificate. Anybody that wants to say otherwise is not being intellectually honest. And if you simply report on them objectively and honestly, it does draw a lot of criticism. And the very same folks that may or may not have a grasp of what ad orientem even is, let alone the implications and the significance of it that we've been discussing, by and large are probably, I'm going to say, oblivious to some of the concerns that we would be reporting on that going on underneath this pontificate. And so they very much can be made uncomfortable when they learn of these things, and there's always some element of shoot the messenger. So there's another divide, I would say, that's started to open up within even what would could be called faithful Catholics, people that attend and practice and regularly worship and observe the tenets of the faith, not just the folks that call themselves Catholic or identify and appear twice a year for Christmas and Easter, the people that are in the pews. A lot of them have been lulled to sleep, I think, in general, and that's a whole other show as to how that's happened and the implications of that, but they're not necessarily receptive to the message that there are some concerning things that have happened and are going on, and so it does make them uncomfortable, and that means that they can become critical or lash out, and it's another little mini divide that has emerged. That maybe not mini, maybe it's maxi, I don't know, but it's there.
Lisa, I have to share with you, because it comes to mind, my most dramatic moment as an outside Catholic journalist when I was at Crisis Magazine some years ago. A number of people came to me and said, you know, we have to do something about pedophilia in the church. Now, this was before Boston Globe articles, before anybody's articles. And because all of this material that was brought pulled together by the Boston Globe was already a matter of public record. And so I decided to find somebody to do it and put together a very good article, comprehensive, put a number on what it would cost the church. We estimated, I forget whether it was $1 or $2 billion, but it definitely has reached that level. And we published it, cover story. And I believe we called it the problem of priestly pedophilia. Now, this was 4 or 5 months before the Boston Globe started their articles, for which they won the Pulitzer Prize.
Mm.
And I got an email from a very prominent archbishop who is one of the real good guys in the church, and he said, why would you publish something so scandalous? And I answered, well, Excellency, function of journalism is to shine light on things that we want to either promote or we want to end. And without the light being shined on them, they won't end. Now, I also got the same message when I publicly was critical of the bishop's role in the, or lack of role, in the Obamacare legislation that included money, federal money for abortions. I was brought to task by another archbishop. I don't know why I was being so critical. And I said, because bishops are not saying much about this. And his response was, well, you Republicans had 8 years to do something about it.
Well, that pretty much.
And again, this is a good guy. I mean, this is somebody who's, you know, 99% of the time on the right side of things. But if you're going to, and I'm really saying this for the benefit of our listeners, if you choose to be a Catholic journalist outside of the officialdom of Catholic News Service or a diocesan paper, your role is to be critical of things that are in need of criticism and in need of having light shed on them, and you're going to get boxed around a little bit. That just comes with the territory. And the only thing that I had going for me was, A, I had good relationships with these people, and so they weren't strangers, and so they were willing to give me the benefit of the doubt. But secondly, I had my facts right. And when you have your facts right and you're not just, you know, shooting blindly, do you remember the case of the book that was published about priests, homosexual priests in the church that named names all over the country and even in Louvain, Belgium? Do you remember that book?
Vaguely. I don't know details, though.
Yeah, I don't need to name it. I'm not trying to
sure
hurt anybody. But in this book, which, you know, basically was a, hey, look, there's a lot of homosexuality among the priests, and there's a lot of it that is, you know, being acted upon and so forth, which is entirely true. But this particular author, you know, really went into naming names. And he named the names of a priest of the Milwaukee Archdiocese who is teaching theology at the University of Louvain, which our listeners may not know is one of the oldest and most respected Catholic seminaries in the world. And it was a place where Thomism was reborn back after Leo XIII called for the revival of Thomism, you know, at the turn of the century.
Mm-hmm.
And Crisis Magazine got asked to look into it because this guy's life was going to be, was being actively ruined by being named in this book. And so my editor, Brian St. Paul, started getting on the phone with people in France and all the... He only named one accuser, named this guy. And Brian St. Paul got on the phone with this guy, and he just turned out to be a total whack job. Clearly unstable, clearly not to be believed. I mean, clearly, you know, you would need somebody else to confirm what this guy was saying.
Mm-hmm.
To be honest, journalist. And so we published an article saying, hey, you know, the book's fine, but in this area, the author went too far and named names against someone who was innocent. And man, the firestorm of the ultra-right-wing Catholics came after me, came after Crisis, came after Brian, because, you know, we had, you know, stepped out of line. And, you know, here was, this was supposed to be the big expose of homosexuality in the priesthood, and we had, Crisis Magazine had, you know, thrown a bucket of water on it. In your reporting with LifeSite News, how much responsibility do you feel to get? I mean, I know what the answer is, but you see a story, but you have to go beyond the story and make sure that the facts are correct, especially when you're being critical of the church or being critical of someone who's doing good work, but, you know, just took it too far.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, we have to be as careful or more careful than anyone, but because we're going to be watched that much more closely. I can't stress enough how much care we take and how much God is at the forefront of what we're doing. You know, we pray together as a staff over the airwaves every morning where I can't say.
Do you really?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
What time do y'all do that?
I have to stop and think because we're different time zones here. We've got folks all the way over on the other side of the continent in Canada and the U.S., but it's 8:30 Central as we all pray together. And pray every day for our readers, our donors, you know, the people that are affected by our work in any way. And we pray for ourselves so that each day, and this is how I term it for myself. I was talking to somebody that I'm working with on a story right now and in very sensitive subject matter. And I said, you know, especially in these cases, before I lay my fingers on the keyboard, I say a prayer and say, God, you know, please drive me and the work on this story in the direction where you mean it to go for your end. So it's very much at the forefront that we are approaching everything, not only journalistically with the same standards or better than any other outlet, but what God's will is. So and that's the nice thing about, I mean, you know, we have that option or that element working for within the church as well, that you're doing the Lord's work. You're not going to get that in secular journalism. So that's why in the case of LifeSite, not being within the church structure, but able to function that way where God is the primary thing, ad orientem.
Right.
It's incredible that way, but I can't stress enough how much journalistic standards and God's will are at the forefront of everything we do. And just because we view it as an apostolate and a mission versus a career or a job, but we also know that we are going to be logistically under a microscope, probably perhaps in more ways than other folks are. We have to be.
Tell our listeners, I mean, many of our listeners probably get emails from LifeSite News, but they may not know the background and the persons involved. Give us a little overview of LifeSite News.
Well, coming up on 20 years, obviously I'm coming up on my second year with them, so I've not been there all along, but it grew out of a pro-life group that's still going up in Canada. And so there's the home office is up there, but we also have an office here in Front Royal in the D.C. area. And then we have folks on several different continents. There's people in South America, and off and on we've had a Rome presence and something in Paris. I've kind of lost track of where all we're reporting all over the world. So and most of this works from home, myself included. So that's a double-edged sword.
By the way, you have the most beautiful children I think I've ever seen.
You have been so kind throughout this interview, Doctor.
You really do. I mean, tell our listeners about your kids.
Well, I have three children, and obviously all children are a blessing. I have two in heaven. We have miscarried two since the three that I have here on earth. But I was told at a young age that I would not probably be able to have children. Doctors just kind of, as they sometimes are wont to do, they said, oh, this is a female problem. You're just, you know, you may have to take this, that, the other drug, and what have you. And, of course, they were wrong. So I have three beautiful children, 19, 17, and 13. And my oldest daughter lives nearby, and she works for a chiropractor as a chiropractic assistant and office manager. She's studying to be a doula because she's very passionate about children and childbirth. She's witnessed a few births in the last couple of weeks toward her certification, and she came back and told us all about them and was ever more convicted in that vocation, and so that's very exciting. She wants to have a lot of children herself. My second oldest daughter is entering her senior year of high school, and my son is going to be entering eighth grade this year, and we homeschool at this point, which is a choice. A beautiful choice, but a very challenging choice because I do work from home, and trying to get them both done, I'm not going to lie, is not easy.
Lisa, you're kind of a perfectionist. You do things right, and you know you pay attention to the jots and the tittles. And someone like you is not just going to whip something off and throw it in and it be in rough form. So that's what. I mean, I notice these kind of things because that's my job, to notice these kind of things. What is your we've got a few minutes left. What are you looking at right now to report on at LifeSite News?
Well, we're watching the church, obviously, very closely because that's so goes the Catholic Church, so goes the world. So we obviously have that as a focus. And then everything to do with life and family and culture, that's our motto. So everything is breaking between the election and the pontificate and everything going on in this country. It's all happening and breaking constantly. So it's literally all we can do to keep up with it.
And I know you were at the Donald Trump meeting in New York in this last minute that we have. Give your impressions of that meeting.
I think a lot of people are very concerned about the direction of the country from a faith-based perspective. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say I do think that Mr. Trump, down deep somewhere, has the best interests of the country at heart. Whether or not he's going to be leading the country, I don't know, or what other motivations he might have, I don't know. But we all need to be on our knees in any case.
Well, and Lisa, you're a great attribute to journalism in the church, and I appreciate your being on Church and Culture, and I want to have you back sometime.
thank you for having me. It's a pleasure and an honor. Always a pleasure to be with you, Dr. Hudson.
That's Lisa Bourne. She's a wife, mother, and journalist with LifeSite News. You'll see her byline there on a regular basis. All of you who are listening, please stay with me, Church and Culture. Be back with another great guest right after this break.
The following is a message brought to you by the Catholic Biblical School of Michigan.
Jesus instructs us to not be afraid. Yet one common fear is that of loneliness or thinking no one cares. This can cloud our lives with disillusion and despair. However, we are never alone. As John's Gospel and letters emphasize, God is love and cares for us so much that he redeemed us through Jesus, his Son. And Jesus did not redeem us as strangers, but as people he knows well enough to call by individual name. On Easter morning, Mary Magdalene rejoiced when she heard Jesus call her name, and Jesus is waiting for us to rejoice as he calls our names each day. Let us pray that we can hear God calling our name and know that we are loved as his children. This message is brought to you by the Catholic Biblical School of Michigan, CBSMICH.
Are you a creative mom or dad? Do you do things that you wouldn't find in parenting books? I found that parents nowadays are a little more nervous about trying those creative discipline solutions that we all have stories of from our parents. A mother one time told me she was a little tired of the runaway threats. She'd been getting them every other day. Skip, about 9 years old, came downstairs one day, traumatized over cold toast, threatened to split after school. Mom didn't argue with him. She just quietly handed him his lunch, packed in a roadmap. This was back in my early days as a shrink. I was a little squeamish. I said, "Ma'am, you did what?" She said, "I gave him his lunch and a roadmap." I said, "Oh, what state do you live in, ma'am?" She said, "Pennsylvania." I said, "What state did you give him?" She said, "Pennsylvania." I said, "Aren't you taking a heck of a chance he's going to find his way back? You got to give him North Dakota. You know they got one interstate through the missile silos." After this mother was done describing this on-the-spot motherhood, I've never read anywhere about running away roadmap therapy. You have to know what she said next. "Did I handle that right? Was it okay that I did that?" She needed the expert to stamp it. Psychologically approved. She was being a creative parent. She quietly got her point across. "Don't do this to me anymore. Without you folks being creative parents, I can't write books. Because 3/4 of my good stuff comes from you." Nice scam, isn't it? I'm Dr. Ray Guarendi.
Florida State Representative Jennifer Sullivan is hard at work making her state a better place. And she credits her homeschool education with paving the way for her success in office. Hear more about Jennifer's accomplishments on today's Homeschool Heartbeat.
Jennifer, what are the biggest lessons that you've learned from your homeschooling experience? And how do they affect the work that you're doing now as a state representative?
I think some of the biggest lessons I learned really came from the flexibility that being homeschooled afforded me. I was in 4-H for 9 years, and I was in Teen Pack Leadership School for 6 or 7 years. And those extracurricular activities where I was able to grow my leadership abilities, learn what servant leadership was, come to understand the role of government, and volunteer on campaigns, I think all of those things, along with having an education system that was based on a Christian worldview and really grounding me and knowing what I believe and why I believe what I believe, really came to benefit when running for office.
Tell us about some of the things that you've been able to accomplish in the legislature.
One of the things I'm most proud